Good afternoon. This is Tamara, reading the Decatur Herald and Review. It's Wednesday, July 2nd. Let's start with the front page. We have a photo of General Manager Drew Gibson and Assistant Manager Brian Tudor posing for a photo in the bar area on Thursday, June 19th at Shore House Bar and Grill in Weldon. From DeWitt County, Vacation Vibes. Shore House Bar and Grill opened for first season at Clinton Lake. Clinton Lake lovers have a new place to eat with the opening of Shore House Bar and Grill over Memorial Day weekend. The restaurant in Weldon is owned by Will and Tasha Bates, who also own the North End Pub and Grill in Sullivan on Lake Shelbyville. The Bates, who have experience in interior design and commercial roofing, completely remodeled the Weldon site, previously known as Barefoot Cove, which had been closed for a few years. The two also own the 32 Marine Supply Store next door, where they offer camping and fishing supplies, boat rentals, other merchandise, and more. The whole vibe is we want people to come out here and feel like they're on vacation in central Illinois. And I think we've done a pretty good job of doing that, said Drew Gibson, general manager at Shore House. The place looks great, it's beautiful, but with a simple menu that people get, they understand, they know what they're getting. They know what they're coming in to eat. Nothing crazy, nothing too fancy or anything like that. Just a nice kind of bar food menu, stuff that's easy to execute and get out. Also very kid-friendly. Gibson, who is from Mattoon and is a Shelbyville High School alumnus, also works at North End and has over 20 years of restaurant experience. He said what he enjoys the most about the job is that no 2 days are the same. He also has enjoyed the new challenge of splitting his time between two restaurants. He previously was general manager at Dirty's Bar and Grill in Charleston. And we have a photo of outdoor seating and lake views, which are a highlight at Shore House Bar and Grill in Weldon. Popular menu items at Shore House so far include the Smash Burger, chicken strips, and boneless wings. Their signature drinks are also popular and include mojito and margarita flights, plus strawberry daiquiris, pina coladas, and other frozen drinks. The restaurant has weekly food and cocktail specials that are posted on its Facebook page. Other menu items include various appetizers and sides, tacos, pizza, sandwiches, and other handheld items, salads, breakfast, fish and chips, pony shoes, pulled pork, desserts, wine, and more. There's not a lot of places you can go sit and just be, have a beautiful view of the lake, you know, at a marina with boats going by. It makes for a really good ambiance and just a cool place where you can just really come and relax and kind of break away from the day-to-day, Gibson said of the location. The guests come out here and kind of get a different vibe, you know, out here at Clinton Lake. We've been told it's fun, friendly, and warm. Gibson said he thinks people are drawn to Shore House because it is considered in the middle for a lot of places, as customers are often traveling from Decatur, Champaign, Bloomington, and even Monticello. He describes it as a friendly, calm, and relaxing place for customers to dine. Shore House is a pet-friendly restaurant carrying the motto of, "We're pet-friendly if the pet is friendly," Gibson said. Live music's offered every weekend, typically from 6 to 9 p.m. on Saturdays, but occasionally on Thursdays or Fridays. I just think it's that carefree atmosphere and vibe, the fact that they just get this large patio to sit on, Gibson said. We have a really, really friendly staff, really great, really good personalities out here, which is also something we strive for when we went into hiring, is being selective about who we hire that kind of fit the attitude of this place. For now, Shore House is open seasonally and plans to stay open through the end of September. Hours are 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. Thursday through Saturday and 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. Sunday. The kitchen's open until 9 p.m. each day, but pizza remains available until 11 p.m. Brunch is offered from 9 to 11:30 a.m. on Sundays, and then lunch and dinner are served until close. Gibson said his goal is to keep the place busy and to continue growing the business, and he would love to be able to expand hours at some point and hire more people. If there's a need for that, we'd love to be able to do that and offer that. We would love to extend that and stay open as long as we can, he said. He continued, "We want families to come out and enjoy the place. We're very family friendly, very family forward. All of us have families, you know, and that's the type of place we want our kids to come also, and relax and enjoy and have a good time as well. Also, just offering a lot of different things for the community and events. If you go, Shore House Bar and Grill is at 6599 Sailboat Road, Weldon. Hours 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. Thursday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. Sunday. Closed Monday through Wednesday. Phone number 309-916-5253. And you can check their website at shorehousebarandgrill.com. From Brendan Moore in Springfield, 2026 elections, Pritzker taps Mitchell for running mate. Just days after making official his bid for a third term, Governor J.B. Pritzker announced the selection of former state representative and deputy governor Christian Mitchell as his running mate for lieutenant governor. Mitchell, currently the vice president for civic engagement and external affairs at the University of Chicago, served as a state legislator representing Chicago's South Side from 2013 to 2019. He was later tapped by Pritzker to serve as a deputy governor overseeing infrastructure, energy, and public safety issues. As a state representative, as the deputy governor of this state, Christian Mitchell has gotten so much done for people, Pritzker said. In a 1.5-minute video released Tuesday morning. And I know when we've got to take on Donald Trump and overcome the challenges he's bringing to our state, that Christian Mitchell is up for that fight. Pritzker added that Mitchell is a proven leader with deep experience, steady judgment, and an unshakable commitment to the working families of Illinois. Mitchell fills the hole left by incumbent Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton, who is foregoing a third term as Pritzker's number two to seek the U.S. Senate seat held by retiring Senator Dick Durbin. Stratton has been endorsed by Pritzker in the Democratic primary of that race. The lieutenant governor is first in the line of succession should the governor die, resign, or be removed from office. The Illinois Constitution prescribes few other responsibilities for the office, instead giving the governor broad authority to delegate tasks to his number two. In this sense, it is the most low-profile statewide office in Illinois. One former lieutenant governor even resigned the office out of sheer boredom and lack of responsibility. However, some have been called upon to ascend to the top job, most recently Pat Quinn, upon the impeachment and removal of Governor Rod Blagojevich in 2009. Illinois governors and lieutenant governors used to run in separate primaries and then unite as one ticket for the general election. But due to a change in state law, gubernatorial candidates have been allowed to pick their running mates since the 2014 election. Pritzker is widely viewed as a potential Democratic candidate for president in 2028, adding greater importance to his pick given the elevated possibility that he does not serve out the 4 years of his third term if reelected. The governor told reporters last week and repeated again on Monday that above all other considerations, his pick had to be ready to become governor on day one and have a heart for all the people of Illinois. In a campaign, you're trying to win all the votes, Pritzker said. You're not going to win them all, but even people who don't vote for you become your constituents when you become governor. In Mitchell, Pritzker tapped someone with both political and policy chops. As a state legislator, Mitchell fended off multiple Chicago Teachers Union-packed primary challenges. In 2018, he was named interim executive director of the Democratic Party of Illinois. In Pritzker's administration, Mitchell was the principal negotiator of the $45 billion capital construction program known as Rebuild Illinois. He was also a driving force behind the Climate and Equitable Jobs Act, the landmark climate law that aims to put Illinois on a trajectory towards 100% carbon-free energy generation by 2050. The selection of Mitchell, who is black, also ensures that Pritzker-led ticket remains racially balanced, an important consideration in a state with a population that is more than 40% people of color. A number of names had been floated in recent months, including State Representative Jehan Gordon Booth of Peoria, who is a member of House Democratic leadership, State Representative Lisa Hernandez, Democrat of Cicero, who chairs the Democratic Party of Illinois, Deputy Governor Andy Menar, who is Pritzker's top budget and economic development official, and Chicago City Clerk Anna Valencia. In the introductory video, Mitchell said that he was molded by his mother, a NICU nurse at Rush University Medical Center for 38 years, and his grandfather, a U.S. Army veteran and union steel worker. They both taught me what it was like to care about your family and work really hard, how you continue to move forward in difficult times, Mitchell said. That's why I wanted to go into public service, because as difficult as life can be, I believe it can be a little easier if you've got leaders in government who care about working families, making life more affordable, and making health care more accessible. The primary election is March 17th, 2025. Again from our front page, Congress. Senate okays Trump's big bill. Lisa Mascaro, Mary Claire Jelonic, and Matt Brown from the Associated Press in Washington, D.C. Senate Republicans hauled President Donald Trump's big tax breaks and spending cuts bill to passage Tuesday on the narrowest of margins, pushing past opposition from Democrats in their own GOP ranks after a turbulent overnight session. The outcome capped an unusually tense weekend of work at the Capitol, the president's signature legislative priority teetering on the edge of approval or collapse. In the end, that tally was 50-50, with Vice President J.D. Vance casting the tie-breaking vote. Votes against the measure included three Republican senators, Tom Tillis of North Carolina, Susan Collins of Maine, and Rand Paul of Kentucky, along with all Democrats, including Illinois Senators Dick Durbin and Tammy Duckworth. Duckworth referred to the legislation as fiscally and morally irresponsible. It's downright shameful that by voting for this bill, Republicans are once again showing they would rather hurt middle-class families and our neighbors who are most in need than make the wealthy pay their fair share of, or show any backbone in the face of Donald Trump's desire to enrich himself and his family, she said in a statement released after the vote. My Republican colleagues will now have to explain to their constituents why they chose to rip away health insurance from families so that millionaires and billionaires can enjoy a hefty tax break, Durbin said in his own statement. The difficulty it took for Republicans who have the majority hold in Congress to wrestle the bill to this point is not expected to let up. The package now goes back to the House, where Speaker Mike Johnson had warned senators not to deviate too far from what his chamber had already approved. But the Senate did make changes, particularly to Medicaid, risking more problems as they race to finish by Trump's 4th of July deadline. The outcome is a pivotal moment for President and his party, which have been consumed by the 940-page One Big Beautiful Bill Act, as it's formally titled, and invested their political capital in delivering on the GOP's sweep of power in Washington. Trump acknowledged it's very complicated stuff as he departed the White House for Florida. I don't want to go too crazy with cuts, he said. I don't like cuts. What started as a routine but laborious day of amendment voting in a process called Votorama spiraled into a round-the-clock slog as Republican leaders were buying time to shore up support. The droning roll calls in the chamber belied the frenzied action to steady the bill. Grim-faced scenes played out on and off the Senate floor amid exhaustion. Senate Majority Leader John Thune of South Dakota was desperately reaching for last-minute agreements between those in his party worried the bill's reductions to Medicaid will leave millions without care, and his most conservative flank, which wants even steeper cuts, to hold down deficits ballooning with the tax cuts. The GOP leaders had no room to spare with narrow majorities. Thune could lose no more than three Republican senators and two, Tillis, who warned that millions of people will lose access to Medicaid health care, and Paul, who opposes raising the debt limit by $5 trillion, had already indicated opposition. Attention quickly turned to two other key senators, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Collins, who also raised concerns about health care cuts, as well as a loose coalition of four conservative GOP senators pushing for even steeper reductions. Then all eyes were on Paul after he returned from a visit to Thune's office with a stunning offer that could win his vote. He had suggested substantially lowering the bill's increase in the debt ceiling, according to two people familiar with the private meeting and granted anonymity to discuss it. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer of New York said Republicans are in shambles because they know the bill is so unpopular. An analysis from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office found 11.8 million more Americans would become uninsured by 2034 if the bill became law. The CBO said the package would increase the deficit by nearly $3.3 trillion over the decade. And on social media, billionaire Elon Musk was again lashing out at Republicans as the Porky Pig Party for including the $5 trillion debt ceiling in the package, which is needed to allow continued borrowing to pay the bills. Few Republicans appeared fully satisfied as the final package emerged in either the House or the Senate. Collins had proposed bolstering the $25 billion proposed rural hospital fund to $50 billion, offset with a higher tax rate on those earning more than $25 million a year, but her amendment failed. And Murkowski was trying to secure provisions to spare people in her state from food stamp cuts, which appeared to be accepted, while she was also working to beef up federal reimbursements to hospitals in Alaska and other states that did not comply with parliamentary rules. All told, the Senate bill includes $4.5 trillion in tax cuts, according to the latest CBO analysis, making permanent Trump's 2017 rates, which would expire at the end of the year if Congress fails to act, while adding the new ones he campaigned on, including no taxes on tips. The Senate package would roll back billions of dollars in green energy tax credits, which Democrats warn will wipe out wind and solar investments nationwide. It would impose $1.2 trillion in cuts largely to Medicaid and food stamps by imposing work requirements on able-bodied people, including some parents and older Americans, making sign-up eligibility more stringent and changing federal reimbursements to states. Additionally, the bill would provide a $350 billion infusion for border and national security, including for deportations, some of it paid for with new fees charged to immigrants. A statement from U.S. Senator Dick Durbin: "Let's make one thing clear. There is nothing beautiful about slashing health care coverage for 17 million Americans. Also, President Trump can deliver a shiny tax cut to the wealthiest individuals and corporations. To make matters worse, Senate Republicans voted to close rural hospitals and take food off the table of millions of Americans, including children, seniors, and veterans, to pay for this outrageous giveaway. My Republican colleagues will now have to explain to their constituents why they chose to rip away health insurance from families so that millionaires and billionaires can enjoy a hefty tax break." And from U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth: "By passing this monstrosity of a bill, Donald Trump and Republicans are proving they are intent on becoming the party of, well, we're all going to die. The big, beautiful betrayal does not make America stronger, better, or safer. It lights trillions of taxpayer dollars on fire to explode our debt and line the pockets of Donald Trump, his family, and his billionaire friends. More than 500,000 Illinoisans will lose health coverage, and hospitals, health clinics, and nursing homes across the country will shut down. Adding insult to injury, the legion of middle-class and working-class Americans who lose their livelihoods will be unable to receive safety net support precisely because of the Republicans who voted for this awful legislation that killed their jobs. There is nothing beautiful about this catastrophe of a bill. It is fiscally and morally irresponsible. It's downright shameful that they, by voting for this bill, Republicans are once again showing they would rather hurt middle-class families and our neighbors, who are most in need, than make the wealthy pay their fair share or show any backbone in the face of Donald Trump's desire to enrich himself and his family." Now from our opinion page, the topic is weight loss wonder. Our first column is from Teresa Fraker, who's the executive director of the Obesity Medicine Association. "Amazing obesity drugs should be standard care. Insulin changed the way we treat and manage diabetes. Chemotherapy has precipitously reduced the mortality rate of certain cancers. Now medications called glucagon-like peptide 1, GLP-1, are reshaping the way we treat obesity. It's incredible to see these groundbreaking medications come to market for patients. Obesity is an epidemic affecting 100 million Americans. Doctors, insurers, policymakers, and employers must recognize the health, economic, and societal benefits of obesity medications and adopt policies that with GLP-1 as a new standard of care. For too long, patients with obesity have been told they must try harder to lose weight. This approach is not only stigmatizing, but inadequate. It causes lasting harm for individuals who are struggling with their condition. It strips patients of dignity, blames them for the chronic and relapsing nature of the disease, and stifles the courage it takes for patients to seek meaningful help. I spent years watching patients come out of surgery and return to my clinic later with additional weight. Like many providers, I struggled to navigate the landscape for obesity treatment that was limited for patients and their families. GLP-1 have given patients hope and redefined the treatment of obesity. The $54 billion market for GLPs reflects the tremendous promise of the treatments as well as the dire stakes of the epidemic. Obesity costs U.S. healthcare nearly $173 billion yearly. With more than 200 related complications such as heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and certainly cancers, obesity is one of the most chronic conditions globally. GLP-1s help patients achieve weight loss and a multitude of other positive health effects. Studies show patients taking semaglutide or tirzepatide can achieve a 15% to 20% reduction in body weight. Patients have also seen statistically significant reductions in blood pressure and lower cholesterol. They have reported improvements in mobility. GLPs could have an antidepressant effect. They've been shown to reduce the risks for serious life-threatening conditions, including neurocognitive disorders such as dementia, as well as major cardiac events such as heart attack, stroke, and heart failure. New and innovative obesity medications offer patients hope and empower them to improve their health without shame. But our healthcare system has yet to embrace these medications as a new standard and ensure patients can access them without cost or coverage barriers. We must be open-minded enough to follow the science and proactive enough to ensure those who can benefit from GLPs can get them. We would not leave treatments on the table for patients with cancer or hypertension. We shouldn't do so for obesity. It is long past time to treat obesity with the seriousness it deserves and with the tools at our disposal. Doctors must move beyond prescribing diet and lifestyle changes. Insurers and employers must cover treatments for obesity the way they would for any other complex chronic disease. Federal legislators and regulators must remove regulatory and coverage barriers that prevent access to these medications in Medicare and Medicaid. Pharmaceutical companies must continue to find ways to make GLP more tolerable, including by making them available in pill form. Patients are brave. They genuinely want to improve their health and they should feel worthy of quality care. All those working to support patients, not just doctors, must align with our oath to act in patients' interest and provide the best possible care. Together, we can rewrite the obesity treatment playbook and tackle the epidemic with urgency and the full force of the latest medical innovations. We'll read the second column from the opinion page in part two of the news of the Decatur Herald and Review. Now, all right. Nutrition column from Barbara Intermill. Enjoying America's food. When our recent road trip across three states concluded, a stockpile of random popcorn kernels littered the floor of our vehicle. It happens every time we take a long trip, and it probably won't change, especially since it's a food that got its origin in the Americas. According to information from USDA's National Agricultural Library, the oldest ears of popcorn, a certain type of corn that pops when dried and heated, goes back 5,600 years from discoveries of cave dwellers in New Mexico. Native Americans naturally used it for food, but also to decorate clothing and for religious ceremonies. Colonists who came to North America were quick to adopt to it as a snack food, and because of its low price, it gained in popularity during the years of the Great Depression. Corn also is a part of a very important American trio. Growing up in New Mexico, I heard long about the three sisters, corn, beans, and squash, but I never knew why they were given this distinction. Then I learned that Native Americans have known for centuries. These three crops nurture each other like family when planted together, says the National Agricultural Library. And like close siblings with different attributes, these three also complement each other nutritionally. Corn and beans, for example, each furnish key amino acids, building blocks of protein, that the other is missing, making a complete protein. And when squash is added to the mix, one gets a high-quality, nutrient-dense meal that has sustained native cultures for centuries. Another American classic was invented by Ruth Wakefield of Whitman, Massachusetts. In the 1930s, she and her husband fed guests at their Toll House Inn. In her quest to find a new treat for her customers, she added chopped chocolate pieces to her cookie dough. Surprisingly, the chocolate did not melt and blend into the dough as she had expected. No matter, her customers loved it, and so did the Nestle Chocolate Company, which bought the rights to her recipe and began to print Toll House chocolate chip cookies on each bag of their chocolate morsels. If you're as old as me, you remember when ranch salad dressing was only available by mail order. This American staple was created by cowboy Steve Henson, who bought the Hidden Valley Ranch in California in 1954 and started serving it to his guests. It wasn't long before his visitors were asking to bring jars of his dressing home. As its popularity grew, he began mailing out packets of his original ranch mix to eager customers, and that's the story of Hidden Valley Ranch dressing. Whatever you choose to bring to your table as we celebrate the birth of our great country, remember that our American food history is a blend of many cultures from several diverse landscapes. Happy 4th of July. From Hints from Heloise, Afternoon Slump. Dear Heloise, I found a great way to beat the afternoon slump we all seem to get after lunch. A new girl came to work in our office and she would bring a light lunch, which would be some almonds or walnuts, a banana, and maybe some yogurt or cheese. Afterward, she'd go for a brisk walk outside in the sunshine. One by one, we all began to follow her example until there were about 20 of us walking down the sidewalk. At first, my boss thought we were protesting, but later joined us when he discovered that none of us got the afternoon slump. By the way, we all love reading your column, Julie G. in Dallas. Stress is a killer. Dear Heloise, I recently read an article about how stress causes us to become more accident prone. If it's financial, marital, career-related, or some family drama, it's hard to get it off our minds, so we often don't pay attention to what we're thinking. Too many people keep thinking, what if I lose my job? What if he or she leaves? Instead, if possible, ask for help, seek counseling, or talk to your minister. But most importantly, do whatever it takes to relieve the stress. From our food column today, we have Simplify Your Summer, 4 weeknight-worthy dishes with 7 ingredients or fewer. Crispy chicken with lime butter. Sheet pan mushroom parmesan. Pork meatballs with ginger and fish sauce. 5-ingredient creamy miso pasta. From Mia Limecooler, The New York Times. I love grocery shopping. My corner grocer has only 2 aisles, and on every visit I go up and down each one to see if there's anything new or anything discounted. Oh, does this recipe need something we don't have? I guess I'll go get it. I fake exasperatedly to say as I'm already walking out the door tote bag on arm. Maybe this isn't you. It's not always me either, especially as we enter the part of the year when it's nicer to spend free time outdoors than under fluorescent lights. In that spirit, here's a collection of recipes that have 7 ingredients or fewer. Today in history, on this date in 1776, the Continental Congress passed a resolution saying that these United Colonies are, and of right, ought to be, free and independent states. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for Wednesday, July 2nd. Please stay tuned.